do some discussion of using astrocartography for problem solving, since this is a training wheels problem solving type of conference. So I can get some idea of the level of knowledge that all of you have, perhaps. You could tell me if any of you have ever been to the astrocartography introductory lecture before. A couple of you. And so, okay, so I should be probably pretty elementary and to the point then. For those of you who have been before, I'm going to be describing a new technique this morning, if I do get to it, which is kind of a new way of looking at an astrocartography map for more advanced students. How many of you are beginning students in astrology? And how many of you are professional astrologers? All right. Okay, so we'll try to slant things for this rather interesting mix of people. What I intend to cover this morning is, first of all, just have a general sort of discussion on how an astrologer solves problems. Then that will lead me into one of my favorite subjects, which is the psychological aspects of astrology, and particularly a concept which I call shadowed planets and how they emerge into consciousness. Finally, we'll get to a quick discussion of how an astrocartography map is created and how it is read, and then we'll see some examples which illustrate all the points. At the end, if there is time, and depending on your questions and responses, we can sort of tell, I will introduce a new technique, which hasn't even been described ever before this moment, on how to read an astrocartography map and determine a life-altering moment, or how a life can sort of reach a culminating point in a way that is shown by a measurement in the birth chart, but it's even more obvious in an astrocartography map. So that's what we're going to do, and obviously we have an hour and 15 minutes. We have an hour and 10 minutes, so we'd better get into it. Basically, when you're an astrologer and you have clients presenting, who's this, please? Because I'm going to use this chair to lean on. If you have clients who present themselves to you, they basically come with two different kinds of problems. And the problems they come are, I would call them, circumstantial and repetitive. A circumstantial problem is basically a problem that is the product of a moment or a particular situation. Some little problem that's happening right now that is obviously of sort of a transitory nature. I can't seem to get the contractors to fix the roof of my house type of thing, right? And then the other types of... Okay, this circumstantial problem, as I call it, is an easy thing for an astrologer to deal with because you sort of identify the transits or progressions in the chart that you identify as being responsible for the creation of this problem, and then you explain why this is going on, and how else would you counsel a client in sort of an immediate circumstantial problem of this kind? What astrological techniques would you use to point to them a way out of this problem?
Transits of Saturn.
Yes, you'd look at the transits, and then perhaps you'd also look at what else as finding a way out. After you've identified the transits and progressions that have sort of caused, quote-unquote, the problem, how would you identify the solution for the client?
Well,
maybe to move. But I mean, looking at a birth chart as a practicing astrologer, I suppose you would look at trines and sextiles to the planet that was affected, right? Say that you have Saturn transiting Mars, and the person's having a difficult time with relationships with men. So you could say, okay, it's clear the reason you're having a difficult time with relationships with men is because Saturn is transiting your Mars. However, I see here that Mars is sextile your Jupiter. So maybe the way that you could get out of this particular problem at this time or expand the consciousness of your Mars is by using Jupiter in some way, perhaps athletics, perhaps going jogging, perhaps doing some, like taking a trip to a foreign country, some sort of Jupiter-Mars thing. So you'd use the trines or sextiles of the significator, that is the planet affected, in order to show the way out of the problem. Right? This is, of course, I guess, basic counseling. However, sometimes a client will present a problem that is not just a one-time affair, that isn't just a circumstantial problem, it is a repetitive problem. Every time I get married, he turns out to be an alcoholic and a womanizer, right? Probably that's the first one you hear most often, right? Every time I do this, every time I get a job, I get fired. Every time, da-da-da-da. When you start hearing the every time I, and you get a history of two or three repeated events of a problem-solving nature, then you know that there's something deeper going on, some deeper level of reality is being accessed by this problem. And I think you sort of deal with it on a different level. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of the time discussing, is these repetitive, deep-seated problems and how an astrologer should probably deal with them. So with that introduction, let's get into sort of a concept of growth and maturation of the psyche. All right. Now, the psyche is, of course, the psychological structure, the inside of your head, call it what you will. And psyches don't all emerge fully grown from the womb. Obviously, the growth of a psyche is a process, just as the growth of a body is a process, just as the growth of anything else. And I think that the process of growth for a human psyche is one of assimilation of unconscious contents. That is, most of the conscious of the consciousness is unconscious. Most of the psyche is unconscious. All the things that have happened to you and lots of instincts and things that happened with your mother in, you know, year three and all that kind of stuff, all of that is unconscious and is suppressed into the unconscious mind. And from time to time, parts of these consciousness emerge. Now, specialization is a very important concept in the world. Why, for instance, do some plants and animals and people, for that matter, go and live up in the Arctic? You think, well, everyone ought to live in a nice, pleasant climate like Phoenix, Arizona, where it's only like 106 outside. And why would somebody go up and live in the Arctic? What a silly thing to do. So that, obviously, the answer to that is that people, animals, creatures, bacteria, anything that exists of that kind, does not enjoy competition. They don't enjoy other things trying to kill them and eat their proteins, right? This is not fun. If you've ever had a lion try to kill you and eat your protein, you know it is not a pleasant experience. So basically, people kind of specialize. They say, well, okay, the lions all live in Kenya, so I'm going to go live in Greenland so I don't get my protein eaten. The psyche is the same way. The psyche also specializes, and everyone does not equally express the planet Venus, or the planet Jupiter, or the planet Pluto. Some people specialize and choose one planet over the other. And this may be caused by your particular heredity and genetic disposition. It may also be caused by your environment. It's caused by various things. But anyway, the result of all this is that certain parts of your psyche become more developed than others. Now, growth as an adult, if you're going to grow as an adult, this means that previously undeveloped parts of your psyche are going to emerge and demand development, or demand some sort of assimilation on your part, assimilation into the conscious ego or the conscious identity. Carl Jung, who is sort of my psychological guru, wrote once that every part of the psyche seeks outer manifestation. Now, you could translate this psychological statement into an astrological statement by making it say, every planet in the horoscope seeks outer manifestation. Every planet in the chart wants to be expressed at some time in the life and seeks outer manifestation. So, some of these planets, though, when their turn comes, and we'll describe how to understand when their turn comes, when some of these planets' turns come to emerge upward into the conscious personality, they cause problems. And every time that they come up, for some reason, they're forced back down again. So they go back down into the unconscious, and they do their push-ups, and they get a little stronger. And then the next time a transit or a progression comes along, they come out again. And this time they're a little bit, you know, meaner and nastier. And this is where you get the repetitive problems that I referred to before, is when a particular part of the psyche attempts to emerge and attempts to express itself in a new way. For some reason, some of them are suppressed and they aren't welcomed open arms into the emerging personality. So these that are, and some of them, of course, emerge very easily. For instance, the planet Mercury. Not a lot of people have problems with the planet Mercury. Well, some do, but in our society, our, quote, information society, unquote, the Mercury is very widely understood and widely appreciated, and there's educational institutions that are all created by the society in order to allow the perfection and expression of Mercury. So it's not going to encounter a lot of problems, unless, of course, you're a dyslexic or something like that, and that means you're having problems with Mercury. But that is a generally more easily accepted planet than, say, Saturn or Neptune or Pluto, which are far more kind of out there and not so socially approved of. So a repetitive problem, as presented by a client, probably indicates that some shadowed planet, as I call them, is seeking outward manifestation and is being resisted by the conscious ego. So, how could you determine if a shadowed planet, if an emerging part of the psyche that has not up until now been accepted as a part of self, is causing... Oh, there are stages. A planet does not simply emerge and sort of spring fully formed like Venus from the forehead of Zeus into consciousness on the half shell. No, there are several stages that you go through before this happens. The first thing that usually occurs, especially when a shadowed planet tries to emerge, is, as I said, repression or denial. You say, oh, no, that's not happening. It simply isn't going on at all. It simply isn't happening. So you don't even accept the fact that this particular psychological process is going on. You simply say, oh, that's not happening at all. This is, of course, called denial, and it's a wonderful human capacity that we all exercise from time to time. Perhaps an example of a psychological pattern and denial and its result is the story of Romeo and Juliet. Here are two happy teenagers going along being happy teenagers in 16th century Italy, right? And they fall in love, as teenagers are wont to do. And yet there is some emerging psychological potential that they deny. What is that emerging psychological potential, and what planet might you equate it with? Saturn. And what is the potential? What's going on? Huh? The family, the structures, the outer structures that control them that they are not really being aware of. And so in their incapacity, in their inability to absorb this emerging Saturn, they suppress it. And so what happens? Tragedy. So tragedy is the result of the suppression of an emerging psychological potential. When something announces that it is time for us to assimilate this particular planet, and you say, I'm too busy now, I can't do that. And you do that to a strong enough degree, tragedy could be the result, as it was in the case or in the story of Romeo and Juliet. And so any presenting problem that an astrologer hears from a client about every time I do this, this is going on, or there's this terrible thing, this might indicate the same type of pattern, that an emerging psychological potential is being denied. And therefore, it is the task of the astrologer to identify and explain that emerging psychological potential. What happens next as a better stage of acceptance? Well, the next stage of acceptance for an emerging psychological potential is what I call repression and projection. This is not to say, oh no, this doesn't exist at all, which is kind of looks like this. see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, right? But it shows rather the whole situation of, well, I know this is emerging and I know this exists, but I don't do it. All those other people are doing it, right? Often this exists with teenagers and sex, for instance, that they all say, well, all my friends are having sex, but I'm, you know, I don't do that yet. This is kind of the stage of other people dealing with an issue and you don't see it in yourself. Now, we'll see that projection and repression is a really interesting concept because it feeds into a whole social pattern. But still, the energy is manifesting externally. The energy of this emerging psychological potential is manifesting externally in the person of other people. Now, a basic rule for all this psychological stuff is that an emerging psychological potential will manifest as an external event to the degree that it is being repressed. The more it is repressed, the more that this particular planetary energy is repressed and refused to be accepted, the more it is going to happen as an external event that seems to be fate. In fact, Carl Jung has a wonderful quote which says almost exactly this. He also says, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate. Okay. So we're beginning to see that things that happen to people, seemingly fated occurrences that happen to people, are not just things that happen randomly or foolishly or stupidly because the dice were thrown and you lost, but rather they represent an emerging psychological potential that has been repressed and therefore is happening outside as fate. Now, this is often the thing that happens in travel. Because when you travel, there is no time to assimilate a new psychological potential. As we know with astrocartography, as we see when we'll get into that in just a couple of minutes more, when you travel, you put yourself into a new planetary situation where new psychological potentials are being very powerfully activated. And perhaps they are ones that you're not quite ready for, and therefore they happen outside as fate. Anyway, moving right along, the next stage of awareness that comes with an emerging psychological potential is what I call assimilation. This is when you start dealing with the planet and you start saying, okay, I have to deal with Saturn, I have to deal with Mars, I have to deal with this and that. And that's when you begin to consciously assimilate and to incorporate that particular potential into your personality. Which all sounds fine, and that's obviously what the astrologer should attempt to do in their counseling. Now, there's another stage which even goes beyond that, and that is when a person acts out a psychological potential, a universal, planetary, archetypal, psychological potential, so well, so terribly well, that everyone else looks at him or her and says, oh boy, this person is doing Mars so well that I'm just going to pay a lot of attention to them. I'm going to watch them. I'm going to see where they go and see what they do. And that way I don't have to deal with my own Mars. This is called fame. A person who becomes so well adapted to a particular psychological potential that other people sort of look up to them and say, oh, hey, you can do mine. You're doing Saturn so well that please take mine on too. They become famous. This is how you become a celebrity. For instance, presidents, they're taking care of our Saturn for us. That is, they're creating a system of laws and external structures. Like, remember, the less assimilated it is, the more it happens outside of fate. So these presidents and politicians are taking care of our Saturn for us. The Pope and religious leaders are taking care of our Jupiter for us. I mean, we can talk to God whenever like we want to. You just sort of call him up on the Cosmophone or her and ask him or her whatever you want. But on the other hand, there are people who set up institutions and say, oh no, you have to go through us. And I do the connection with the divine so much better than you do that you should give me money and I'll take care of yours for me. This is another example of someone acting out Jupiter so well that they are feeding into all those people who are in denial or in repression about their own Jupiter. By the way, it's not fun being a object of other people's projections, because they demand that you do certain things for them. You cannot be your own self. And if it comes time for you to grow beyond that role that you have all of a sudden been in for, say, 10 or 15 years, everyone out there is going to say, oh, wait a minute, you can't do that. You can't grow beyond that role. We need you to do that. I mean, you've been taking care of our Jupiter all this time, and we're not about to, carry our own Jupiter. So I'm sorry, you cannot leave. And that perhaps brings up issues like, who was the televangelist who got caught in the motel with the... Anyway, there's a whole bunch of them, actually. There's a whole bunch of them, and that kind of shows what happens when you get, when you're a young man, you think, well, I'm just so holy and great, and God's talking to me, and then you get a little bit older, and you find out some other stuff, but your followers won't let you evolve, so you have to sort of sneak out the back door, and then, of course, someday someone catches you. So, anyway, this whole structure, the point of it, is to describe a bit that that every planet seeks outer manifestation and emerges in certain stages into conscious acceptance. Okay, every planet in the horoscope seeks every potential aspects, planets, everything seeks outer manifestation and emerges in certain stages into conscious acceptance. Some of these planets encounter more resistance than others. Resistance by the ego, I don't want that thing to happen to me. And these are called shadowed planets. And remembering that when an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate, we can see that an encounter with a shadowed planet is more apt to manifest as an event. This is particularly true in astrocartography when you travel to a place where a shadowed planet is angular, where there's a shadowed planet's line. Okay, so that's the really important point. Is it's really important to realize that if you happen to travel to a place where a shadowed planet is on its line, then there you are probably going to experience external events that relate to those planets. And also another important thing is the longer a shadowed planet is ignored and the greater number of times that it is forced back down and repressed, the greater the charge that it'll have when it gets up next time. And it'll become more and more fateful and eventful and probably negative in manifestation. Okay, let's look at a chart. This is our example chart. It's also in your book on page 52, I think. How would you identify a shadowed planet before we actually look at this chart? Let's just say, how would you generally identify in a horoscope a shadowed planet? Where would you expect it to fall in a chart? Now, I don't have a blackboard, so we'll just have to sort of list these in our head. Huh? On the angles? And I think quite the opposite. If it's on the angles, it's probably not a shadowed planet. It's probably a really powerfully accepted planet. Cadent, yes. If it's cadent behind the angles, it might be... Now, all of these things aren't going to apply to a planet, but if two or three of them, there's a list of about eight or nine different ways that you can recognize a shadowed planet in a horoscope. And they all don't apply, obviously, to any planet. If you see any planet that has all of these, that's really far out. But if you get, four out of five or, many of them, then this planet is going to be somewhat more shadowed than the other. Okay, so if it's cadent, what else? If it has stressful aspects, especially by outer planets. Also, if it is opposite or squared, but more opposite, the sun or the moon. Obviously, if the sun is where your consciousness is, and your sun is opposite Saturn, then your sun isn't compatible with Saturn. It doesn't like Saturn very much, because Saturn is out there and you're in here, and so you tend to see it as an external factor, and therefore it's hard for you to assimilate as part of yourself. By a similar train of thinking, a planet in which houses might be more shadowed? Eighth house. Twelfth house. Fourth house, I don't think so. No, because that's a family type thing. So you associate that with yourself. Sixth maybe. Seventh house. Because the seventh house is always the house of the other. Now here's you in the first house, I live in the first house, and over there is the seventh house. So any planet in the seventh house tends to be associated with other people. In fact, addition, any planet on the western side of the chart at all is associated with other people. That is, like, the western side of the chart, as you know, is the chart of the external reality, and so that any planet on the west is just a little more shadowed than the same planet would be on the east. Other things that might show a shadowed planet. Debility, yes. If it is in an adverse sign or in a house that it doesn't belong, that would add just a little tendency for it to be hard to absorb. Other parts, other ways this has occurred. If it's unaspected, if the planet is unaspected. Also, if it's a singleton, you know, if all the other nine planets are all sitting over here in a comfortable, you know, cluster, and then this one planet is standing outside there all by itself, and there is an example of exactly that in this chart, then that planet is going to be hard to assimilate because it is standing against and opposite to all the others. So any planet that is associated with a not-self idea. Now, the planets of the self are what? The sun, the moon, right? And maybe Venus if you're a woman, or Mars if you're a man. Any planet that is associated with a not-self idea, like Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, or Pluto, is going to be more difficult to assimilate. So that I'm saying that Saturn is almost always shadowed for everybody to some degree. Moreover, if it's a planet that is against your elemental nature, if you're a man, Venus is hard for you to understand. It's not easy for a man to understand Venus the way that our culture distinguishes between men and women. It is more difficult for a woman to understand Mars. So these planets are slightly shadowed just by virtue of their being from the opposite sex from yourself. Yes? Planets, if they're exactly conjoined the sun, it's called Kazemi, and that's and often if a planet is exactly conjunct the sun, that's a very good point. It gets kind of lost, and you can't see it because it's sort of lost in the glare of your own ego, and you don't even see it, and so that is often also a projected planet. Also, if it's retrograde. So anyway, this is a whole list of ways. Now, obviously, any planet that's retrograde is not a shadowed planet. But if it's singleton, if it's this, if it's that, and the other thing, then you can say, okay, this planet's going to have a harder time emerging than others. Looking at our example chart here, how would you... could you find any shadowed planet? Which do you think are the most shadowed planets in this chart? The sun is in the midheaven in Capricorn, the moon's in Leo, Taurus is rising, and you see the other planets as they are arranged around. Ignore these for the time being. These are transits and progressions for an event that we'll describe. Saturn in the seventh. Why? It's in the seventh. Yes, it's Saturn in the seventh. Yeah. Now it's the sun ruler, so that makes it. But it's in the seventh house, so I think that and Saturn is always shadowed. We said it's always a difficult planet. So Saturn in the seventh, and someone else said
Mars,
right? And why Mars? In the 12th house in Pisces, and it's a singleton. I mean, you could. You know, there's an opposition across the chart here, and all these planets are on this side of that opposition, and Mars is standing out there all by itself in Pisces in the 12th house. And this is a woman. So Mars is obviously going to be a real problem for her. And so is Saturn, because it's in the 7th house. So we can certainly see that for this woman, Saturn and Mars are shadowed planets, and that's not unusual. Because Saturn sort of archetypally represents the father, and Mars is the opposite sex. So these planets are always going to be shadowed for any woman to some degree, but for this woman especially because of their house placements. Also, Saturn is exactly square the moon, 1839 to 1909. A woman identifies with the moon, so that's one more reason that Saturn is highly shadowed. See if we've covered everything. Now, at the same time, these planets are not badly aspected. Saturn's part of sort of, or Mars is part of a large grand trine, or a loose grand trine, with the seventh house and the fourth house, and it sextiles the Sun kind of widely. Saturn is exactly sextile the Sun, so I mean, this isn't a real problem. This is not a real crisis, but it's going to be pretty interesting to see all these shadows emerge. Yes?
Wouldn't you say it would be the Moon because it's approaching Pluto?
Excuse me? As a shadowed planet. Well, as we'll see, the moon is part of this whole thing, so that's a good observation. Like, there was an event in this person's life, a problem that happened in 1984, and we'll see that the moon was very much a part of that. So that's a very good thing to observe. But the moon, of course, is for a woman's chart, the moon is kind of the seat of consciousness, so that she's going to find her moon more comfortable than Saturn and Mars. But indeed, the almost conjunction of moon to Pluto is certainly powerful, and the aspects of squaring Saturn means that it's going to be part of this too, as in fact it was. Okay, so how is a shadowed planet activated? When does it start pounding on the ceiling of the basement that we keep it locked in for the first, you know, 20, 30 years of our lives, and we find it pounding on the ceiling of the basement saying, I want to come up into the light of consciousness? And how is it activated astrologically? Most of the time it sits down there in the basement and quietly pulls its strings and attracts you to bosses who resemble your father, or attracts you to relationships that resemble your mother or your sister. It sits back there and just is sort of a quiet little psychological thing that happens, and it doesn't bother. Kind of like the Wizard of Oz who pulls all the strings from behind the curtain. But when does it come into consciousness awareness? When is it that a psychological potential demands attention, says, okay, no more basement for me, I'm going to march up the stairs and walk around in the living room in front of all of your friends, right? When does it do that? Well, there are three circumstances shown by astrology that might activate this emerging psychological potential. One is time, as exemplified in progressions and transits. Obviously, if a planet gets an important progression or transit, then that is going to activate it and bring it out of the closet. If, like for example, the Progress Sun in 1984 has moved to 19 Aquarius 11, at which time it is exactly opposite the moon. It has just passed its opposition to the moon, and it is just exactly square Saturn. This is a time when this whole moon-Saturn problem is going to demand some sort of conscious acceptance. Similarly, in 1984, we can see that there was a Saturn return, that Saturn was in 14 degrees of Scorpio, so you were having a Saturn return at the same time, and therefore, of course, transiting Saturn was square Progress Sun. So at the same time you had the Progress Sun activating all of this, you had the Saturn return, which we all know is, like you all know what a Saturn return is? Yeah, okay, that's of course the time at the age of 29 in every chart when Saturn returns to its own natal place, and that happened to be going on at the same time the Progress Sun was activating that. So this is one time when the shadows are going to start marching up out of the basement and parading around in the living room, right? Okay, so no matter who you are, time is going to cause the emergence of psychological potentials. For instance, even Helen Keller, you know, deaf, dumb, blind, can't say anything, can't feel anything, still, thoughts are going on in her mind, and at a certain age, thoughts are going to form themselves in new ways, and psychological potentials are still going to emerge. So, when transits and progressions aspect a shadowed planet, either it emerges into consciousness or events occur that demonstrate its desire to emerge into consciousness. It gets repressed. You say, oops, I don't want to deal with that. That was just an accident. had no meaning at all. Nope, I will not deal with that. It gets forced back down into the basement where it does its sort of push-ups and sit-ups for another few years until the next chance, and it comes up even stronger. So that time is one of these things. What's another factor that can cause or identify the emergence of psychological potentials into the psyche? What is one more event that can do that astrologically? What is another activity that people do that shows their stage of psychological... No, that's the astrological thing. We just did that. But what I mean now is relationship. When you get into a relationship, you are putting yourself into an astrological climate which can cause or which can symbolize the emergence of a psychological potential. If, for instance, you marry someone whose Saturn conjoins your Sun, it's kind of like having a transit of Saturn all the time that you're in the same room with that person. So that is going to bring a psychological stress onto your Sun and force its psychological acceptance. And finally, the third means of a emerging psychological potential to be identified is locality. You can move to a new place. You can move to a new location or be brought to one by circumstances, quote, circumstances. It happens outside as fate. So you can be brought to a new environment where a planet is brought into consciousness. Ready or not, it'll come into consciousness when you're brought to that new environment. So we can see that there are three different astrological ways of determining when a psychological potential is going to emerge. Transits and progressions, as this gentleman mentioned, that shows the time factor. Synastry, or the comparison of two charts, shows the relationship factor. And astrocartography shows the locational factor. If you're doing good astrology, you should be able to find all three of those operating at the same time. If it's really happening, if the psychological potential is really demanding its time in the sun, then you can find all three of those operating at the same time, which is the exact thing that we'll see with this example. So let's just sort of summarize all this and then go on into astrocartography. Repetitive problems are an indication of emerging archetypal or planetary potentials that are being repressed. Why? Past encounters at ages and stages of consciousness occurred when it was not possible to assimilate those things. Like a trauma occurs when a psychological potential wants to be absorbed and you aren't ready for it. Like you aren't strong enough or big enough to do this yet, so it emerges but you can't handle it, so it gets pushed back down and also gets some negative stuff attached to it. So that's what happens if a potential emerges too early before you're ready for it. It acquires kind of a traumatic sensation to it. It gets pushed back down and occurs later. So to solve, quote, solve, unquote, this type of problem, the astrologer should do several things. He or she should look at the chart for aspects as means to link the emerging psychological potential with other more productive life activities. He should also look, or she, should note the times of manifestation of this thing. Like, go back in time and find out other times that this psychological potential has manifested, and note them down, and then observe ones that are going to happen in the future by progression or transit. And finally, you should bring the history of all this to consciousness for the client. You should say, obviously your problem with relating to men goes back to your relationship with your father, and it might be best dealt with by like working with the trines or the sextiles, da 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 da, in the way that you normally would counsel. So, and also, of course, like you get them to try to see this as an emerging psychological potential, that they are part of a process that is going on. Okay, before we get into astrocartography directly, is there any questions or quick observations on this stuff? The psychological stuff, or shall we get into the astrocartography directly? Okay. What is astrocartography? That we're going to find is a very useful tool in identifying these particular psychological potentials. And we'll come back to our example chart a bit later and see how an example of all this worked. Now, astrocartography, as we all know, as I guess most of us know, is an astrological technique that allows us to determine places in the world where certain parts of the psyche or certain astrological, psychological, archetypal potentials are liable to manifest. In astrology, as I'm sure you're very much aware, the angles of the chart are the individuating factor. Well, let's see, I'm getting ahead of myself here. What is a horoscope? What is a horoscope really? I mean, of course, it's a key to the understanding of the psyche and the unfoldment thereof, blah, blah. But what is a horoscope really? It's a picture of something.
The relationship of the planets and the solar system.
At exactly the time and place of birth. It is a picture of the sky at the time and place of birth. Now, in this horoscope, the sun actually occurs in the chart in exactly the place that it occupied at the time you were born. For instance, if you're born at 7 a.m. At about this time of year, the sun would appear near the horizon of the horoscope. This is the ecliptic. The circle of the horoscope is the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the path through which the planets move in the course of the day, the apparent path of the planets caused by the rotation of the Earth in the course of the day. So the planets all move through the ecliptic. Now, the ecliptic is intersected by two important planes. One is the horizon, which is the horizon. You simply look out and you see the horizon. And if you didn't have the mountains or the buildings, you'd see the horizon. So that's what this plane here is. The other plane is called the meridian. And the meridian is sort of basically the plane that identifies up and down. So it identifies up and down for a chart. So you have basically three planes, the ecliptic, the horizon, and the meridian. And the intersection of these planes create four very powerful points. The intersection of the horizon and the ecliptic is what we call the ascendant, and it is the point on the east. The intersection of the horizon and the ecliptic on the other end is called the descendant in the west. The intersection of the meridian and the ecliptic is called the midheaven, and we show it as the top of the chart. And of course, opposite that is the IC, or the Eumumquelli, and that is seen as the bottom of the chart in a standard horoscope. So the planets now are located in the chart as they actually existed in the sky at the moment of birth. So that if you were born at dawn, the sun will appear near the ascendant on the horizon of your chart. If you're born at 10 in the morning, the sun is higher in the sky, so it appears in this house. If you're born at 3:30 in the afternoon, the sun will appear in the eighth house because it's on its way for setting. And if you're born at 10 p.m., the sun will be under the earth where you can't see it. So the sun in a chart shows the place where the sun actually was at the moment of birth. That, I'm sure, is clear to you all. Now, in astrocartography, there are basically two basic concepts. They are relocation and angularity. So there are two basic concepts in astrocartography, and they are relocation and angularity. Relocation identifies that what happens when you move from point A to point B. Well, let's say that you were born at 10 a.m. in New York City, and as we saw before, the sun would appear in approximately the 11th house cusp of your chart. So this is your birth situation. However, saying that you moved to San Francisco at the age of 27. In San Francisco, at the moment of your birth, the sun was not in the 11th house. Like, you can't change the moment of your birth. That you're stuck with, right? So at the moment of your birth, the sun was not in the 10th house, in the like 11th house as it is here. It was more on the ascendant in San Francisco, because when it is 10 a.m. in New York, it is 7 a.m. in San Francisco, right? Because of 3 hours time zone difference. So at the moment you were born in New York, the sun was on the ascendant in San Francisco. If you had moved to Hawaii, the moment you were born in New York, the sun was in the second house in Hawaii, because that's still 2 hours further to the west. It hadn't even risen yet in Hawaii. If you had gone the other direction, if you'd gone to the east, at the time you were born in New York, at 10 a.m. in New York City, the sun was in the 8th house in London, because it was already 3 p.m. there. And of course, India would be here, and Iran would be there, and so forth and so on. So every place in the world would identify the sun in a different part of the chart at the moment of your birth. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. Now, the other important factor in astrocartography is the factor of angularity. And angularity identifies that certain parts of the chart are more powerful than others. That if a planet happens to be in one of these red angular zones near the midheaven, the ascendant, the IC, or the descendant, if it happens to be near one of those, it's going to be more powerful than if it's someplace in between. These are called the angular power zones, and if you happen to have the sun or any other planet in these zones, it's going to be more powerful than if it is not in those zones. So that's the second thing. You now have the fact that if you move from one place to another, the planet moves in relation to the houses. And you also have the fact that if it happens to go to a certain house, it's going to end up being stronger than it was before. Now, another way of looking at the chart is represented by this fetchingly beautiful rendition of the planet Earth as seen from outer space. And as you can see here, the sun is beautifully shining on the sort of middle part of the Earth. And this is the line that identifies the demarcation between the illuminated part of the planet and the dark part of the planet. So at this particular moment, which is the same as our birth moment for the example I just showed you, this line identifies the distance, the place between the light part and the dark part of Earth. So it is dawn anywhere along this line, as seen on the globe, right? So that's easy to understand. Now, the next thing is taking that globe and putting it on a flat map. Now, that same line we just saw on the globe now acquires a bit of a wiggle because of the fact that it's a round globe and a flat map. And it's basically, though, the same line. Here it is, 7 a.m. in San Francisco, and it is dawn right here. It is also dawn right here. It is also dawn right here. It is also dawn in Tierra del Fuego. It's also dawn in Alaska. So it is dawn everywhere along this line that we just saw on the globe. Now, an opposite line on the opposite side of the world would be a sunset line. And here is where the sun was setting at the moment of our native's birth. So at the moment that it was dawn in San Francisco, it was sunset in Calcutta. It was sunset in Ceylon. It was sunset out here on this little tiny island where the penguins were sitting, right? So this line, which is opposite to the other line, shows where the sun is setting at the moment of our person's birth. Now, to have the sun in the midheaven, noon is always halfway between dawn and sunset, right? So the noon line here is going to be halfway between dawn and sunset. So here's a point there, and there's a point there, and it becomes a straight line because it's halfway between these two curved lines along the entire length of the line. So this is where the sun is at noon, in Iceland and in Mauritania and in Dakar. And so the sun is on the midheaven anywhere along this line. The sun is on the IC, which is the fourth angle, anywhere along this line, which goes through New Zealand and the Pacific Ocean. So we have seen that by drawing four lines on the map, we have shown every place on Earth where a planet was either rising or setting or straight overhead at the moment of our birth. So by drawing these four lines across the map, we now have identified every place where the sun was angular at our birth moment. And that's how the lines on an astrocartography map are created. Is that clear to everyone? If you have any questions, ask them now, because we're going to try to, I guess, put all this stuff together in a minute. Now, of course, we take these lines, and then we draw the same kinds of lines for the Moon and Mercury and Venus and Mars and Jupiter and blah, 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 and we get this standard astrocartography map. I should mention, by the way, just in passing, this is as good a time as any, I suppose, that I am giving an astrocartography seminar in Berkeley in 2 weeks. And here are some brochures I'll pass out a few. If someone's interested in becoming a certified astrocartography interpreter, I'll spend 2.5 days on all this stuff. If you'd like to order an astrocartography map, you can do so from me. It comes with a book, and you can fill out one of these. So these will be up here if you're interested. Okay, so moving along, we have the lines on the map indicate the places where the planets were angular at the moment of birth. Okay? So, how do you read this map once you get it? That, of course, is the next question. And the answer that is, well, we can't cover everything in complete detail in this the short lecture thing. But generally speaking, let's just find a map and put it up there. This is our example map, which is also in your book on page, 53. And I've added some stuff in here which we'll explain as we come to it. But this is, of course, a black and white, which is a bit more difficult to read, but you see all the different lines. Let's observe several techniques for reading the astrocartography map. Obviously the line that is closest to a particular place is going to identify the planetary energy most liable to emerge in that place. The line that is closest to a particular place will identify the planetary energy most liable to emerge in that place. So you can sort of you can go to a place and say, okay, I'm looking for Venus. I really want Venus in my life, so I will go to a Venus line. You can be transported. Your job can involuntarily move you to a place where you are subjected to a particular line, and that would probably clue you off to the fact that maybe that psychological potential is seeking to emerge in your life in some way. How close do you have to be for this to work? Well, the orb is really quite wide, but the closer you are to the line, the more powerfully it manifests. In this example map, for instance, Phoenix isn't on here, but the Mars ascendant line would be probably closest to Phoenix, and also between that and the Pluto descendant line, and both of them would operate. The idea being that you'd have to be sort of about 500 miles or 600 miles either side of the line, there will be some manifestation. 500 or 600 miles either side of the line, there is some manifestation. But the closer you are to the line exactly, the more powerful that manifestation will be. Yeah?
Does it matter which line it is, if it's the descendant line?
I'll get to that in a moment, yes. How about if you're going to a place where there are no lines at all? What do you think that would mean? If there are no lines, what do you think that would mean? That you don't exist, that you cast no shadow, that you have no reflection in it's like an astrological house without anything in it. That's a good analogy. So it is there. It's operating. It's kind of, there's no emphasis. The point in a line is that it shows the emphasis of a particular planetary energy, its emergence into consciousness. If there's no planetary energy there. If there's no line there, it simply means all parts of the chart are equally accented. The meanings for each angle are roughly in keeping with the traditional meanings of each angle. That if it's on the midheaven line, it manifests in your position in society. That people see you in society as a manifestation of that planet. If it's on the ascendant, it's your outer personality that expresses that planet's energy. People see you as the outer expression of that planet's energy, that you seem to typify that planet. If it's on the descendant, that's the most apt to be projected position. That's where other people tend to symbolize that planet for you, that other people seem to be acting out that planet for you. And finally, if it's on the IC, is probably the most interesting and unexpectedly important of the different positions. The IC is the foundation with which you are equipped when you come into this world. The IC is your family, your religion, your race, your ethnicity, your social class, all the things that you are brought into the world with, or perhaps I should say the family, the race, the religion, the all that, of your family that you're brought into. It's kind of the context, the particular individualized context into which you emerge when you are born. Now, a planet on that line means a change of that context into something else. So that if you go to, for instance, the Uranus IC line, you are going to transcend your family, your race, your background, your class, your ethnicity in order to become a larger person, a more Uranian type of self-actualized person, as opposed to one who is simply responding from that family heritage. So a planet, particularly a disruptive one like Uranus on the IC, means that you are going to transcend your background in the nature of that planet. Okay, beings of each angle, let's see. Generally speaking, I have a whole list here. Let me get through that, and then if you have questions, we'll get to that. You don't have to go to a place for a planet line to manifest. If you simply deal with it remotely, it will still manifest. For instance, Jimmy Carter had his Mars and his Jupiter in Iran. He didn't have to go to Iran. It sort of came to him. And Mars and Jupiter are both shadowed planets in Jimmy Carter's chart. They are they're aspected in such a way that they are shadowed planets. And so when he became president, where he had sort of a worldwide span of influence, Iran came to him in the person of the Ayatollah. It sort of manifested outside as fate, and we all know the result of that. In fact, actually, I have Jimmy Carter's Mars lines here. This is a sort of an excerpt from Jimmy Carter's map, and you can see here that these are his Mars lines, his Mars on the ascendant, his Mars on the descendant, his Mars on the IC, his Mars on the midheaven, and this is his Jupiter midheaven line here. And you see that his Mars on the ascendant crosses his Jupiter on the midheaven right in Iran. So what is going on in Jimmy Carter's chart in Iran? If Carter had been born in Iran instead of in Georgia, how would his chart look? There are two things you'd know about his chart just from this map if Carter had been born in Iran instead of being born in Georgia. Jupiter would be in the midheaven. Right, because that's what the Jupiter midheaven lines mean, is at the moment that he was born, Jupiter was in the midheaven anywhere along that line on the map. Also, we know one other thing about his chart. Mars would be on the ascendant. So if Jimmy Carter had been born here, his horoscope would have Jupiter in the midheaven and Mars on the ascendant. Now this leads us into a really interesting sideline about astrocartography that's extremely important, and that's called crossings. And crossings are also called parans. And the thing about a crossing is that, of course, any two lines cross on the map, and that means that in the zone around those two lines, maybe a 600-mile radius anywhere around that crossing, is a zone where both of those planets manifest, both of those planet lines manifest. But there's something else in addition, and that is that anywhere along the latitude of that crossing, anywhere in the world, those lines, those two planets are also interrelated. And that is an extremely important sort of new theory that's come out of astrocartography, that this crossing happens to be at 38 degrees north latitude. So anywhere else at 30 degrees north latitude, that includes Japan, Korea, China, Turkey, Spain, Washington, D.C., how curious, San Francisco, and all these other places, that anywhere along that line of latitude, these two planets are related. Now, are Jupiter and Mars related in Jimmy Carter's chart? Are they in some aspect, do you think? Not necessarily. I mean, they might be square, and then again, they might not. Because the fact that both of them are angular at the same time doesn't really mean they're related in an aspect way. Because it simply means that one is on the midheaven and one is on the ascendant. They don't have to be squared. They might be, but they don't have to be. Just as the ascendant is not always square the midheaven. Well, sometimes it is, but usually, in fact, it's not. So this is a new form of relationship of planets that can be seen on an astrocartography map. And it operates anywhere on the latitude that that crossing occurs. Now, there are two ways of finding out where these crossings are. One is you can look on your astrocartography map and take a ruler and run it up and down and just see where the crossings are and the latitudes that they affect. By the way, the orb is about 1 or 2 degrees either side of the line. So this one would operate within, say, from 40 degrees north or 39.5 degrees north down to 36.5 degrees. You know, it's only about a degree or two orb either side of that line. So anywhere in that range across here, Jupiter and Mars are related for Jimmy Carter. So that's, of course, one thing that you can observe with crossings. And they don't have the same power as the major lines. The major lines are, of course, a big deal. That's an emerging psychological potential. That's a destiny with fate. That's a blah, blah, blah. That's a big deal. The crossings are not nearly as powerful. Maybe they're about a third as powerful. But there are two ways of observing them, I was saying. One is to actually measure them on a map with a ruler. And the other is that along with your map, on the next page of your booklet, you'll see that there's a listing of crossings for the client. And if you order an astrocartography map, you get that listing of crossings along with it. And so on the following page, see, we have, first of all, her example, then we have her astrocartography map, and then we have this weird listing of crossings here. And the crossings show the actual latitude of every crossing on her map so that you can get the exact latitude. Also included are the latitudes of various large cities, so you can see the large cities that are affected by the crossings. So that's the other way, is to look at the latitude crossing sheet. Okay. Finally, there's a couple more points on reading an astrocartography map. One is that, kind of in keeping with our psychological introduction that we described beforehand, that different planets will react differently for different people. That everyone going to a Jupiter line is not going to have the same effect. If you're a Sagittarian and you like wearing lampshades on your head and telling off-color jokes at church, socials, and all those other things, then you're going to get along much better on your Jupiter line than will a Virgo, who finds all of that stuff, you know, sort of unpleasant. So also, if you're a woman, your experiences under a Mars line are going to be different than that of a man. How would you describe that? Well, let's just say that, well, for instance, if a man goes to, keeping with all of the stuff that I've described so far, all the emerging psychological potential stuff and all this, if a man goes to his Mars line, how is he going to behave? you know, how would you counsel a man who's saying, okay, my job has been relocated, I'm moving to my Mars line, tell me what's going to happen? Huh? He'll be more aggressive, more macho, more like these salesmen out in the hall we've been dealing with, right? You know, hey, Bill, how much did you sell this week? You know, yeah, yeah. Unless his Mars is repressed, and then he's in trouble. Very good. Exactly right. Exactly right. If his Mars happens to be a shadowed planet, which is kind of a problem for a guy anyway, but it certainly does happen. If it, yes, sir.
Jupiter, Mars, other things would mean big and aggressive.
Exactly right. Exactly right. The I'll repeat it for the tape. The guy said that Jimmy Carter's chart is an example of that because Jimmy Carter was sort of a diplomatic, meek and mild, sort of compromising type of person. So when his Jupiter and Mars together, big aggression, inflated aggression occurred, it happened even more for him outside as fate in the person of the Ayatollah. It's exactly the point that I'm trying to make with this whole lecture. So please try to observe it. And with presidents particularly, I'll be doing Bill Clinton's chart tomorrow during the lunch, and we will see he is another Jimmy Carter type, and so his Mars lines are going to be particularly difficult for him. So we'll see where those are tomorrow.
We decided to talk about the Mars for women.
All right, so we've seen how the typical guy will go to his Mars line, and he'll become more aggressive, unless he's a person who has a shadowed Mars. For a woman, how is she going to experience Mars, do you think? She will find a guy, more likely, unless she's a person who's really assimilated her Mars. But actually, the point is that she will begin the process of assimilating her Mars. That it'll come probably in an external event, read guy, and then after spending a period of time with him, for a long period of time or a short period of time, she'll begin to assimilate the Mars herself, if in fact she's open to psychological growth. And the same is true for Carter. I mean, he learned a lot from the Ayatollah, even though he's probably not too happy with the results. Okay, are there any other questions about how to read the astrocartography map? We only have a few minutes before, oh my God, we hardly have any time at all. We only have a few minutes to put all of this together into our example. So do you have any quick questions on astrocartography? Like 11, no, we started at 10:35, so it's now 11. Yeah, I can squeeze it all in, but we're going to have to move kind of fast. So let's go back to our example, and let's go back to her map here and look at her chart in the book, if you need to observe her shadowed planets. We already observed that she had certain shadowed planets, and that they were Mars particularly because of its 12th house Pisces thing, and Saturn because of its strong 7th house Scorpio stuff. So those are the two outstanding shadowed planets. Both of them, by the way, are tied up with the 7th house because one is the ruler of the 7th, because Scorpio's on the cusp and Mars is co-ruler Scorpio, and the other is the occupant. So we know that when these planets are activated, we're going to have some 7th house type activities with relationships, and because this is a woman, it's probably going to be with men. When is this apt to become critical? When is this particular problem going to be most manifest in her entire life? Well, I've already given you the answer during her Saturn return, and which also happens to be the time when her progress sun was opposite her moon and squaring her Saturn. Note in her chart that the closest aspect that she has is Saturn square the moon. So anything that has to do with Saturn is going to also involve her moon. Also, what's on her midheaven? Capricorn and Cancer are the signs on her midheaven in IC. So that, consequently, this is a theme that's going to be poised against her home and family theme. The home and family are also going to be involved in this in some way. So the history, the story of all this is as follows. and we'll have to go through it kind of quickly, so let's pay close attention. She had moved away from the east where she was born. She was born in Canada, sort of right here where this red arrow crosses the sun midheaven line, or right here on the astrocartography map. She's born in Windsor, Ontario, about there. She had moved away from the east and over to the western part of Canada in order to escape her family, right? So at that time, she was what? She was shadowing her Saturn. Saturn is the ruler of her 10th house. Saturn is the ruler of her sun. So she's moving west in order to escape her family and all of its trips, all of its Saturnian trips. In the summer of 1983, Saturn entered Scorpio. There was an eclipse in Capricorn conjunct her nodes, and her progress sun opposed her moon. So she goes back to Toronto on business, which is just about here. There she meets a man, 7th house, Saturn, who is black, Saturn in Scorpio, who offers her an invitation to go to carnival in Trinidad. She says, oh, that's really nice, and completely forgets about it, right? In February, that is to say, there was a little emergence then, and then, press back down into the basement. I don't want to deal with you right now. Back to the basement, please. In February 1984, he sent her a postcard saying, well, I'm expecting you to come down to Trinidad and join me for carnival. And she said, what the hell? Why not? So she impulsively went and arrived on March 3rd, 1984. She arrived at the airport in Trinidad. She was, in her own words, immersed in a sea of black men. This was March 7th, Ash Wednesday, which I think has symbolic significance as well. She had an amazing time there. I mean, they just treated her like royalty. She went to this incredible week-long party and had probably the best time of her life. All the time, of course, she was absolutely terrified, but she was dealing with her terror in a very positive way and saying, this is a new experience which I have to embrace. She didn't say this is an emerging psychological potential that I have to assimilate, but this was exactly what she had decided to do. She said one of the most impressive things that occurred was that everyone there was a parent except herself. She was, almost 30 years old. She was the only person there who was not a parent, that all these guys had 5 kids and all these women had 5 kids. And they said, where are your kids? And she said, I don't have any. And they all so this is the influence of the moon exactly square. The night that she left, it's a whole long story, but basically a guy who she'd become sort of fond with walked her out to the pineapple field and said that she had changed his life because he had always hated white people, and that she was the first person who ever made it obvious to him that white people were people. And of course the opposite was also true, but it shows that coming from him, it was still a projected thing from her 7th house that she had to assimilate in order to assimilate it. By the way, at that time, Saturn was stationary retrograde at 19 Scorpio, right on top of her Saturn at the time that all this was going on. On the way home, she called up a friend of hers in Ottawa from a payphone, and this guy was a Capricorn, and she went back and spent 6 weeks with him. She had various affairs at that time with guys, all of whom seemed to be Capricorns or have powerful influences in Capricorn at the time. In 1987, she met her future husband and married him and gradually got into politics as an advisor to highly placed political people in Canada. Okay, so what does all this mean? How did all this happen? Well, I don't have to show you, or perhaps I do, that the Saturn descendant line of this chart goes exactly through Trinidad. I mean, absolutely right smack down the middle of the street of Trinidad. It also goes through New York, it goes through Ottawa, and it traces everywhere that was important in this whole thing. So her Saturn descendant line was exactly through Trinidad, through Ottawa, through Montreal, through all these places where this had occurred at that particular time. So we see here that it was the Saturn return, it was the Saturn line, it was a whole bunch of Capricorns, it was dealing with all these heavily symbolic things. Of course, you know the old Roman name for carnival was what? Saturnalia, yes. So, I mean, the precision of the symbology in this case is absolutely mind-blowing. Now, in addition, the latitude of Port of Spain, Trinidad, is noted on here someplace, 8 degrees north, 48. It passes exactly through a crossing of Moon and Saturn. It passes through another crossing of Saturn and Moon. So in addition, the Saturn-Moon crossings are exactly at the latitude of the place that she went on the Saturn line where, you know, all of that went on. Roughly, that's, I guess, what I should say about this since I've only got a couple of minutes. There is a new technique which I would like to point out to those of you who are astrologically sophisticated. The latitude of her birthplace is 83 West 01. That is Windsor, Ontario, which is actually the same as her sun midheaven line because her sun's exactly in the midheaven. Her moon IC line occurs here at 54 degrees West 17. Now the difference between those two, 83 West, 54 17, and you can actually use our new astrocartography maps with our new plotter, have exactly calibrated degrees, and they're close enough that you can actually use the degree readings off the map. You subtract the two, you get 28 degrees 44 minutes, or 28.73. You divide by the progression ratio, which don't ask me what it is now, I don't have time, 0.98565. If you divide 28.73 degrees by 0.98565, you get 29.151 years. That's the age that this particular line would progress to that particular line. And on March 7th, 1984, her age was 29.155 years, or just a few thousandths of a degree from being exactly that. So the new technique that I'd like to show you is that you can progress a line across the map by using this particular like ratio, and you don't even need to do this final step if you're willing to work approximately. And that if you find that a place where you're born or a place that you're living, that's the important part, happens to reach another line at this particular age, then something very significant is going to occur. As a final example, maybe I have just time to do this one because it's such a hot example, is Allen Ginsberg. Oh, okay. As you can see from her astrocartography list of crossings, Saturn and Moon, Port of Spain is at 10 degrees north, 39. Saturn and Moon are at 12 degrees and 9 degrees within a degree and a half of Port of Spain. But let's do... Do you all know who Allen Ginsberg is?
Of course.
Yes, okay. Allen Ginsberg, this is his birth chart, and the time used here is 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which is an approximate time, and Lois calls it dirty data, so you can't be too trustful of it. At the same time, when you see how this worked, it will blow your mind. I'm quite sure now this is the correct chart. Anyway, it certainly shows a poet. I mean, Uranus in Pisces on the ascendant, Sun in Gemini in the third house, square the moon in Pisces, all of this. Anyway, like, you would not see anything of also an isolated Saturn, a singleton Saturn. I mean, we have a very shadowed Saturn here, don't we? It's singleton, it's in Scorpio, it's opposite the Sun, sort of very widely. I mean, a really shadowed Saturn. And again, a shadowed Mars, also in Pisces. It's kind of strange, this is Saturn in Scorpio, Mars in Pisces again. Anyway, using this technique which I just showed to you of progression, something very interesting occurs in San Francisco. Now, there was a time in Allen Ginsberg's life when he sort of instantaneously became famous. It's when he first read the poem Howl, which is the poem that really put him on the map in San Francisco. And the date of that was October 19... Oh, dear, I don't have it. It was October 1954, I think. I have it somewhere, but I'm in a hurry here. Allen Ginsberg, read Howl. I don't have the date. I believe it was October 1954. I will not bother to describe all of this stuff because it's so much stuff. But if you take the latitude, the longitude of San Francisco, 22 west of 26, subtract the Sun-IC line, 92 west of 93, that is the distance between San Francisco and the Sun-IC line is 29.88. Divided, you get 30.31 years. He read Howell at age 29-37. So that, again, you saw the local midheaven for San Francisco progress to the Sun-IC. The thing that's really intriguing is that the Sun is not only on the IC here, but Jupiter is on the ascendant. So he simultaneously had his local midheaven in San Francisco progress to the paran of the Sun and Jupiter. His Sun is in Gemini in the third house, and Jupiter is in Aquarius and the 12th, so it is a perfect thing. If you ever see a person's local midheaven progressing to a crossing of the Sun and Jupiter, you can say that is the time and place to go for you to become rich and famous like Allen Ginsberg did. So, we got through all that. Are there any questions? Yes.
What I'm doing as photography, I notice you get hard aspects of the midpoints that don't show up, and if you said, say to a person, they want to go to a moon spike, then they just see this light. If you have a lot of hard aspects that are not showing up, then what are they?
Hard aspects.
Midpoint squaring, you can have quincuxes, so it's like. You might have conflict.
Yes, that of course is true, and that is basically visible in the vert chart, because if you have a reading of midpoints of the planets and the aspects from the chart, you can kind of get the flavoring of the astrocartography line. I absolutely agree that everyone's individual astrocartography line reflects the disposition of the planet in their chart. That's also true, yes. But I would frankly use the map and be sure to use those params, because those are extremely powerful questions.
Comment, in
this sample chart, the old ruler, Mars, goes with that Saturn.
Yes. And whenever I look at science, I always look for the Saturn. That's absolutely true, yes.
Yes, it is. Indeed, or at least in regard, at least from the point of view of the white race, Saturn is the black race. From the point of view of the black race, I think that the white race is probably Saturn. But I think almost certainly that would be the case. But indeed, each is each other's shadow. And this example of the carnival, the Saturnalia on her Saturn return on her Saturn line, was just mind-boggling. Other questions, observations before we go have lunch? Thank you very much.